Today's Taisho will be on case 10 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku. Case 10 is entitled Bokushu's Empty-Headed Fool. Engo's introduction. Yes is yes, no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands on his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones, and the religious teachers of the whole world become spiritless and silent. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, all creatures become brilliantly illuminating, as independent as a 10,000-foot cliff. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward? If there is any rule, rely on the rule. If there is no rule, follow a precedent. See the following. Main subject. Bokushu asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk gave a "Kots!" shout. Bokushu said, "This old monk is shouted down by you." The monk shouted again, "Katsu!" Bokushu said, "What about the third and fourth shouts?" The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, "You empty-headed fool." Secho's verse, two shouts, three shouts. The knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world. So I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning. When I ring the bell to start the sit, I try to go into deep samadhi. And because I've been doing this for so many years, I have a good feeling for where the 25-minute point is. Every once in a while, I lose track of time, and a couple Wednesdays ago, I completely blew it. I blew way past the half-hour mark. So that can happen, but I try very hard not to make that mistake. So generally, I have a good feeling for 25-30 minutes. And so, you know, I try to go into samadhi as soon as I ring the bell by counting my breath and watching my breath and then calling mu. And then, you know, I try to stay down in deep samadhi for the duration of the period until I feel like it might be time to come up, or to come out. And then I come out and look at my watch and either go back in a little bit or skim on the surface or ring the bell. When I'm skimming on the surface, one of the things I often do is look around the zendo. I'm interested in how well people are sitting. And after the first sit of our second session, before I went down into samadhi, I looked around the zendo and everybody was sitting so still, so motionless. Everybody was in samadhi, really is samadhi. That kind of motionlessness requires deep samadhi, Even if part of your brain is still very active, you're in a place that's very different from ordinary consciousness. You know, most people can't sit with that kind of motionless attention for very long at all without practicing. And it's signaling to me that your mind is in a very different place from ordinary consciousness. Many years ago, we were worried that Murray Grove was going to go under financially, where we have our sashins. So I began to investigate other possible sashin sites, and there is a temple in North Jersey called Bodhi Monastery. And we had to go up there and meet the teacher, Roshi or Shifu at that place, and his lieutenant, his second in command. And lieutenant, the sort of second monk in command, asked everybody to wait in a room, like a library or a waiting room, where there was a big table and there were all these chairs. And he purposefully left open the window. And so the interesting thing is that when we were all sitting there waiting for him, even though we weren't sitting on mats, everybody went into deep samadhi. And when he came in, everybody was just absolutely, we weren't chattering away, we weren't fidgeting on our chairs, just absolutely motionless, deep samadhi, watching the breath. I think that under ordinary, I think he was testing us to see what kind of Zen practitioners we were. And indeed, even though he himself, I think, has a long way to go, he was not a very awakened person, in my opinion. Even though he himself had a long way to go, I think he could appreciate how deeply we were sitting. That kind of concentration is really quite excellent. And everybody here has been practicing for a while. To be able to sit two sits in a row in deep samadhi like that, or some of you have been here since early this morning to do three sits, or if you came at sutra recitation, even more, you know, without moving. This is easily taken for granted. You know, beginners can't do this to save their lives, right? Beginners can't do it to save their lives. And some people have a very hard time for many years with this, finding this still place. You know, many years ago, we had a guy in our group who really wanted to. He had read some books on Zen, and he really wanted to be involved with Zen. But I think he wanted to be involved with Zen because he thought it was very cool. And I think he also wanted to be a Zen master, and right away, very quickly. So anyway, he had an interesting motivation. You know, if you practice Zen, your motivation should be to wake up. That's the proper motivation for Zen practice, to become an awakened bodhisattva and a person who will help other beings wake up. I don't think that was his motivation. And he had a very, very hard time sitting still. He would be fidgeting almost all the time, just sometimes very subtly. I would look over and see, like, one of his feet would just be fidget, 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 just very subtly. Or sometimes he would bob back and forth on his cushion. He'd go a little bit forward, a little bit back, a little bit. So when I opened my eyes and surveyed the Zendo, I could see him sort of rocking back and forth very subtly. So when we would talk about his practice, he would say, "I think I'm getting better," and I would say, "No, you're not in deep. You're not in samadhi." Okay, so no, I am. I'm in samadhi, I assure you. And I say, "No, you're not. You know, you're not really. Believe me." He said, "How do you know? Because you're moving all the time." He said, "No, I wasn't moving." And this would go on and on. So he wasn't in samadhi, I assure you. You know, when people go into deep samadhi, You know, you're in a different state of consciousness. You're in a different state of consciousness. Your body and mind are interacting in a very different way. And, you know, once you can get into this state, you can get into this state more and more deeply and more easily. It's easy to take it for granted. You know, it's easy to think, oh, yeah, of course I can sit not moving for half an hour. But you don't understand how, not just how difficult it is to get to that place, but what it really means that you can be in that place. You know, one of the things is that when people do meditation, you know, your baseline consciousness changes. But from day to day, it doesn't feel like anything is happening. You know, if you do Zen for 10 years, you're a different person. But you don't notice it often because your baseline changes a little bit every day. So you don't, it's not like you sit down on the cushion and you get up and go, I am a different person. It's just one day you become a very different person, you know, if you practice this for a while. You know, samadhi is a different, really different kind of consciousness. You know, when people, you know, when scientists wire up people's brains, you know, when they wire up people's brains, they can see what we might not appreciate, how differently the brain functions when you're in that state. You know, the different parts of the brain go silent. Parts of the brain that are normally very active go silent. And parts of the brain that are normally sort of damped down become more active. And, you know, the parts of your brain that are associated with, like, motion, movement, and a spatial perception go to sleep almost. And the parts of your brain that are, certain parts of your brain are processing information very actively, very actively. And, you know, if you get very good at this, you know, your hemispheres actually synchronize. Now, you know, if you're sitting on the cushion, you're not aware that your hemispheres are synchronizing. You're not aware that parts of, you know, you may feel like your spatial orientation is changing, so you may feel disembodied and so on. But the point is you're really processing information very differently, you know. And you're not in that normal thinking mode. You're in this other, I would say, more integrated mode of knowing. Integrated. You know, meditation takes place on a mat, on a cushion. And it has a physical dimension, you know? And this is difficult for people. This is difficult for people. It's hard for people to sit down on a mat and watch their breath for half an hour. And when people do this initially, you know, they encounter all kinds of obstacles related to their bodies, you know. So basically when people sit down on the cushion, you know, after, say, 15 or 20 minutes, people will say, oh, my leg went to sleep. Or they'll say, I'm having a lot of pain in my shoulder, or I'm having a lot of pain in my hip. You know, I'm sure a lot of people think, you know, this is just not for me, you know, I just don't want to have pain in my shoulder. Or I just don't want to have pain in my knee. You know, this is, meditation is, you know, so crude. It's like, why do we have to put up with this pain? Why can't we just sit in a comfortable chair? But you know, actually, that's a very good question. You know, the answer is really complicated. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you straighten your back and you breathe through your hara, again, you're doing things with your body that change your consciousness. So deep abdominal breathing definitely influences your mental, your mind's behavior. Definitely. It's really well documented. You know, for a little while, we had a gentleman in our group who was a professor of endocrinology at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical Center, and he had done some studies on meditation. And he said, you know, they have found, he said, that when you meditate, it actually affects your endocrine system. It starts performing in a different way. So even your hormones are performing in a different way. So there's all this subtle transformation of the human being on the cushion. But it definitely requires you to sit on a cushion. And part of the experience of sitting can be some degree of physical discomfort. It's just a fact. Now, you know, this is actually very significant, very important. Because actually, people have physical discomfort all the time, all the time. You know, NSAIDs are some of the best, I think the biggest selling drugs are antidepressants. I think the next best, biggest selling drugs pain relieving drugs, right? Physically, you know, so people have lots of problems with physical pain, whether they do Zazen or not, you know? So, you know, my wife has developed arthritis in her knee. And I don't know whether they may have to do some surgery on it. I don't know, you know, but when she gets up in the morning, very painful. First getting out of bed is painful, right? And then walking downstairs until it gets to move a little bit. Then it gets better. She has a torn rotator cuff. So sometimes lifting her arm is painful. But I know so many people who are like this. So, you know, actually physical pain isn't produced by sitting on the cushion. It's something we carry around with us all the time. But normally, we screen it out. We screen it out, you know. So if you're in a meeting and your leg hurts, you just keep shifting and you don't even pay attention. You sort of register out of one side of your mind that your leg is hurting, and you adjust your posture, and you adjust your posture, and you adjust your posture. But you pretty much focus on like who's the person who's talking with on you or making a presentation. If you're writing, you know, I spend long hours sitting in front of a computer. Sometimes I get a neck problem because of that, and you know, but I just sort of tune it out, right? I tune it out, and I focus on my work. And this is kind of the ordinary way we relate to our bodies. We relate to our bodies in a kind of an unhealthy way, believe it or not. So, you know, we try not to be too much in our bodies. This is a fact. You know, so as we go through the day, we try to be a little bit in our body, but not too much, you know? And we sort of tune out what the body is saying to us. We tune it out. I had one of the people who used to work in my program, my writing program, was this wonderful woman named, I'll just say her first name, her name was Suzanne. And Suzanne had come from a very difficult upbringing, physically abusive, emotionally abusive, working class family. She was, you know, got a PhD in English, and she was working for me. What happened was that she, over the weekend, she had her appendix ruptured, and she had to be rushed to the hospital, and she almost died. And the doctor said to her, you know, didn't you notice stabbing pain in your stomach? And you know, she said, you know, he actually asked her to see a psychiatrist because she had pushed that so far down out of her consciousness, you know. You know, she said, well, I thought I might have had a little, you know, maybe there was something going on there, right? So, I mean, this is an extreme case of somebody who's very, very far away from their body. But it's not as unusual as you would think. So, you know, here, the, you know, if your intestines, I mean, if, pardon me, if your appendix rupture, it's exquisitely painful. People weep, right? It's very, very painful if they get close. If you have an appendicitis attack, very painful. People throw up, they writhe. But, you know, if you've cultivated a habit of not being in your body, which is very commonplace, you know, it's possible even to ignore the screaming of an appendix that's about to rupture. This is an extreme case, but it's not so odd. We have a strange relationship to our bodies in the modern world. You know, I was talking to my sister, and she's very concerned about her older son, who is, I think, about 11 years old now. My older nephew is has been suffering from like depression, and so she's been taking him to a therapist, and he's only 11, but he's suffering from some kind of depressive disorder. When I go to visit my sister, who I love very much, you know, I notice that my two nephews are on the computer from the time they get up. It's like they wake up, they come downstairs, and in the kitchen, the computers are on the counter in the kitchen. Both of the kids have a computer, and they're on the computer all the time. And so I'll come downstairs and say, "Hi, how are you?" And it's like, you know? And they're literally glued to the screen. And they're glued to the screen like from dawn till dusk, almost. Not quite literally. My sister does take them out to events or athletic things. But, you know, anyway, my sister was talking to me about the fact that her older son has begun to exhibit symptoms of depression. And, you know, since I don't have kids, I really make a point of not telling people how to raise their kids, because I have no idea what that's like. But, you know, as we were talking, I said, "Well, can I just send you something?" Because it was an article by this Journal of Pediatrics, and it said that, you know, parents should limit their children to no more than 2 hours of screen time, TV or computer, a day. And that the average American kid is like putting in, you know, 5 or 6 hours in front of a computer. And the interesting thing was that they said, here are the symptoms, that these are the problems or the dysfunctions that are caused by this kind of behavior of obsessive, and it said, obesity. My sister said, check. Next thing, depression, check, you know, and anxiety disorders, check. You know, so that's my nephew. My feeling is that, you know, our body-mind relationship is very, very complicated and subtle. And, you know, I think my nephew is in a disembodied state almost all day long. I really do. I think he tunes out not just his body, but the whole sort of material world. And he's in this virtual world, right, where, you know, things make little buzzing noises he's in a disembodied world. And this is a more extreme case, again, than usual, but lots of people live in a disembodied world, right? Disembodied. You know, it's a little different case from my friend Suzanne. But not in your body, not in your body. And lots of kids are like this. Lots of kids are like this. You know, years ago, when I was in graduate school, I used to have some summer jobs that would allow me to make a little extra money. I was working with this guy who was like a physics genius. His name was Neil. And Neil was also trying to make a little money, and so this this man, my wife worked for, Andy Shiga, was his name, Mr. Shiga, who ran an import business, had given me some summer work remodeling a house that he owned. And he hired Neil to come in and help me. And Neil was like very unpresent, to say the least, in his body. You know, and so Andy would explain to Neil, this is how you, have you ever painted a room? Neil would say, no, I've never painted a room. Well, Andy would say, put the drop cloth down, then you stir the paint, then you do the corners with a brush, then you roll the center of the wall, with a roller. And he explained it all to Neil. And anyway, when I came in, Neil had spilled, it was like, oh, I'm glad you got some paint on the wall, because most of it was on himself.
Right.
And he had, as he was painting, he was dripping huge quantities of paint onto the drop cloth. He would walk on the drop cloth and then step all over the floor, defeating the purpose of the drop cloth. And, Andy came in and he said, what's with you, this... But I knew this guy, and he was not very present in his body, right? Not very present. People make a habit of being disembodied, not present in their bodies, and this can be very, very reassuring, very insulating. So my nephew is has really not developed emotionally in a healthy way. And so, he has anxiety because he lives kind of an isolated life. And, interacting with other people can create anxiety. It does, But he tunes it out by sort of losing himself in his computer. And, and Neil, in a little healthier way, maybe, or way that society rewards more, he would just sort of live like in a physics world, right? In his head, we say, and out of his body. And this is very widespread, thanks to our technology, but it's always been a problem. When we think of ourselves, since ancient times in the West, we think body and mind. Right, or body and soul, and we think of the body as something that is secondary, of secondary importance, and we think of the mind as something very exalted, and the mind is eternal, or the soul is eternal, and the body is, people in the West used to say corrupt. So the body is like dirty or corrupt, and the mind can be pure and it's eternal. See? So who wouldn't want to spend all of their time in the realm of the pure mind, not in this filthy body? You can see how our ancestors in the West formed those opinions about the body. I mean, look. The body is in some ways like this uncontrollable thing. It's like uncontrollable. So if you have to go to the bathroom, you can't reason your way out of it, right? You just have to go, And it can be embarrassing. I'll never forget going to a talk, and the very eminent speaker just said, "Excuse me, 1 minute." And he left and he came back, and I'm sure he just had to take a pee, I hadn't ever seen that before, but, it can happen, right? So we say when nature calls, right, you have to hear the call of nature. But we try not to hear the call of nature. We have a very ambivalent relationship to our own body because we can't control it. So, the body... is uncontrollable in all kinds of ways, right? So if you eat something, sometimes you get indigestion. You didn't plan on it. You can't make it not happen, and now you're stuck with indigestion. And you know, if you sometimes, if you if it's a very stressful day, you might come home and you notice you smell a little bit from all that excreting all those anxiety hormones, right? You know, the body can be smelly. You know, when the body is uncontrollable. You know, you have uncontrollable urges, right? We all have uncontrollable urges. And so, you know, and the other thing about the body is that it's the place where our helplessness and vulnerability are most obvious to us, right? It's the place where we see how vulnerable we are and also how dependent we are and connected we are to everything else. So the body, no wonder we don't want to look at the body or admit that we have a body. Because the body is really so vulnerable, right? If you don't have water in 2 days, you will die. You know, if you don't get food, you'll starve. You know, if you fall down the stairs, you can die. You know, this. So the body is the place where we have to admit that we're in the world, that we're part of this world, right? And it's uncontrollable and it's vulnerable. And, you know, we grow up with all of these experiences of not being able to control the body or feeling tied down by the body. You know, so basically, everybody in this room has been a teenager, right? And if you're a teenager, you probably had the experience of despising the way you looked, you know? So at least in some cultures, in the West, you know, when you're about 14 years old and you look at yourself in the mirror, everything about it is wrong, right? It's like nothing is right. You know, people have skin problems, their noses are too big, their ears are too big, their neck is too thin, you know. So we go through this whole ambivalent relationship with our bodies. Our body is uncontrollable. You know, one day you go to the doctor and the doctor says you have cancer. You know, you didn't choose that to happen. You know, you eat broccoli once a week, but you still have cancer. So the uncontrollability of the body is hugely important. Hugely important. But we, especially in Western culture, we treat the body with complete contempt, right? It's always an object of our discipline, you know, discipline. It's not a friend, it's not our master. It's not our master, it's our slave. It's not our teacher, it's our animal, right? You know, so this is our relationship to the body. And it's deeply in our culture and it's deeply ingrained in our attitudes as a result of growing up. So sitting on the cushion, in being present with your body, is hugely important and hugely challenging for people. It's challenging. Because, you know, we live in this disembodied, ideal realm, right? Where we're on the internet, or virtual world, there's no materiality at all. Or we're in our books, where there's no materiality at all. Or we're in our calculations, you know, where there's no materiality at all. You know, sitting down on the cushion and being present with your body is a big step to take, and one many people just aren't comfortable ever taking. It's just too difficult. And the other thing is, you know, when you do meditation, you have to let the body be the master. You have to let the body be the teacher, see? So, you know, when I started doing meditation, I was so disappointed that my teacher gave me the breath perception koan. He said, watch your breath. And I was disappointed because I had really literally believed he was going to take me into the Dokusan room and give me a secret something to meditate on that would be like the wish-fulfilling gem in Buddhist scriptures. You know, I would meditate on this and I thought my body would disappear, time and space would disappear, I'd be in this pure realm of, you know, absolute bliss or divinity, or and that would be my Zen, you know, that would be enlightenment. So instead he said, I want you to watch the breath. And I had utter contempt for this, you know. I felt like, would you, why are you giving me the this, you know, this infantile task? Give me something advanced, you know. But I, you know, and I sat down on the cushion and I would watch the breath, and you know, breath goes in, the breath goes out, the breath goes in, the breath goes out, you know. And it, to me, it just seemed really inane, really pointless, and there was, you know, there's no intellectual content here, right? Just watching the breath. So, you know, I tried to give it an intellectual content, you know. So when I would go into Dokusan and talk to the teacher about my practice, you know, I would try to make the breath important in some way by dressing it up in ideas. And Genki Roshi would just ring the bell. He said, no, you're not watching the breath. You're not watching the breath. You're not. So, you know, finally, I was just watching the breath. And, you know, it took me a long time to work with the breath perception koan, because I couldn't understand, I couldn't learn from the breath. You have to let the breath be the teacher. You have to let the breath be the master. You know, so you sit on the, you know, and if you do enough zazen, you are going to have pain in your legs. You'll have pain in your legs if you sit in a chair long enough too. But when you're sitting on the cushion, you have nothing else going on except being in your body. You know, that and your distracting thoughts. So there's no computer, there's no movie screen, there are no books. So now you're stuck on the cushion in your body with your distracting thoughts, and you're trying to focus on your breath. And if for many people, this is a profoundly difficult experience. You know, people don't want to be in their bodies. But, you know, if you watch the breath, after a while you realize that your understanding, your intellectual understanding of the breath has nothing to do with the way you experience the breath. And so if you experience the breath, you become the student of your breath, right? You follow the breath out, and you notice that as you start following the breath out repeatedly, your mind goes into this different place. It's like suddenly the mind, which is on sort of like drifting or darting back and forth, if you focus on your breath, the mind begins to be still and grounded. It begins to be planted firmly somewhere, you know, firmly planted actually in the body, in the moment. And so you follow the breath out and you begin to feel different. You begin to feel. Before you understand anything, watching the breath makes you feel different. You're in a different place even if you can't describe it intellectually. So you follow the breath out, you follow the breath out, and you begin to notice, you know, the breath has this, the breath can be, you know, the breath can feel like it's going out your forehead. It can feel like it's going out your chest. The breath can be long, it can be short. It can be thick, it can be thin. It can be as fine as spun gold. It can be coarse as sandpaper. Right? If you learn from the breath, you know, you become a real student of the breath. Now, eventually it takes you to this altered state of consciousness. And in that state of consciousness, actually, body and mind are unified in a more natural way. In a more natural way. It's like we're processing information now in a different way, with body and mind restored to unity. And, you know, when you get off the cushion after doing zazen, sometimes you go outside and you realize that everything feels so alive. Everything feels so alive. The other day we came out of the Zendo and there was a big moon, a big yellow moon over the horizon. It was so moving to see
after doing zazen for three periods, because we were in a different body-mind place, you know. You're processing information in a different way. Even information about your own thoughts, you're even processing your own thoughts in a different way. So this practice of, you know, of sitting on the cushion is really an amazing practice. You know, there's nothing, I don't think humans have invented anything else like zazen. You know, it's incredibly clever and interesting because it, you know, it starts right off by forcing us to be present with our bodies, to reunify with these bodies that we so dislike and distrust. But the body is our link to the world. The body is part of this world. And the mind, you know, the mental world we live in is an imaginary space in which we think, you know, we can escape from this world. And the interesting thing, too, is, you know, actually, when you're in your body, you're not Kurt anymore. And that's another interesting thing, isn't it? You know, I answer to the name of Kurt. I definitely pick up my check every 2 weeks, and it has my name on the check, or I used to before direct deposit. You know, I have an office, and in the office it says Kurt, you know, so I do go by that name. But, you know, actually that is a kind of fantasy. It's a fantasy. It is. It's a fantasy. It's part of the life of the disembodied mind. And when we sit down on the cushion and we ground ourselves in the body, you'll notice that sense of self is one of the first things to disappear. You know, so being present in the body profoundly unifies us with everything in the world. And the sense of self disappears because it's kind of a fantasy we create in our minds. And this is just the very opposite of the way Western people think of it. They think the real self is the mental self and the body is the false self. That's not who I am. That's just a stopover on my way to eternity. See, that's how Western people think. This body is corrupt. That's what they actually, I'm a literary scholar, I can tell you. You know, they said this corruptible body, it's subject to lust, sickness, smelly, it creates excrement. What a vile body, right? Fortunately, I have this brilliant mind that can transcend. This is Western thinking. But it's 100% wrong. It's wrong. The body is our path into the world. And actually, even though this sounds strange, the body is eternal. The mind is ephemeral, temporary. The body is eternal. When you are in your body 100%, there is no time. There's no time. It's just pure present, this present moment. There's no self. See, just present in this body now. So it's 100% wrong. You know, the idea that this is just a stopover. The body is the eternal. The body is the universal. And the mind is ephemeral. It's here and it's gone. You know, your deepest thoughts aren't even your thoughts, right? Somebody else, you know, mental life, ideas are like money. They circulate. You know, so when I write something and I think, oh, hi, you know, I'll think, I'll write something like the house of being. So I'll write a phrase, the house of being, and think, oh, that's so beautiful. Where did I come up with that? And then I'll think, oh, that was from Heidegger. You know, I didn't invent that. That was from Heidegger. You know, much of what we think is ours in our mental lives is inherited. It's just circulating like money. You know, you might use your money wisely or you might use your money foolishly. And you might not use your money at all. But it's these ideas are really quite ephemeral, quite trivial. And even though ideas themselves may sometimes seem to have this immortal character, actually they're very fleeting. So I don't want to beat up on the mind too much. But, you know, we haven't really appreciated the body and the sacredness of the body and how essential the body is to awakening and how essential the body is to Zen practice. So, you know, one other thing, you know, we can live in a world of pure bullshit. You know, we do often. My teacher Genki Roshi said that at Ryotakeji once this very famous French philosopher came to visit and did a sesshin. And the French philosopher had written on various aspects of Zen. And he didn't make it through the sesshin. He actually left, and he told the Roshi, apparently, said, if I stay here one more day, it will completely destroy my philosophy. I think that's so revealing. You know, when you sit on the cushion and you're in physical pain, you can't think your way out of it. You can't fantasize your way out of it. You can't. You know, in the immediacy of that discomfort, you have to stop relating to the world in this isolating, disembodied way. You know, if you have a good mind, that's wonderful. You know, the capacity to be a Heidegger is something that's really special. The capacity to be a Paul Krugman, a Beethoven, these are wonderful achievements, you know. Wonderful. So I'm maybe going a little overboard in a way. But on the other hand, you know, when you sit down on a cushion and you begin to have pain in your legs, it cuts through all the crap. You know, those castles in the air evaporate, and you're right there with your body, and the question before you is, what are you going to do? How are you going to interact with the world? You can get up and run out. You can focus on the breath, you know. But what you can't do is make it go away with your the part of your mind that thinks, you know. And that's powerful medicine. Powerful medicine, because we become prisoners of our thinking. We become prisoners of these fantasies we create that seem so real. And then you sit down on the cushion and they evaporate like clouds in the sunlight. So it's okay to be an empty-headed, in short, it's okay to be an empty-headed fool. Bokushu asked, Engo's introduction, yes is yes, and no is no. In the Dharma battle, each stands on his own ground. Therefore, it is said, when one's activity is upward, even Shakyamuni, Maitreya, Manjushri, Samantabhadra, the thousand holy ones, and the religious teachers of the whole world become spiritless and silent. When one's activity is downward, even maggots, gnats, and all creatures become brilliantly illuminating and as independent as a 10,000-foot cliff. In other words, upward is this beautiful disembodied realm. Downward is the body. The maggots, the shit. Okay. However, how is it when one's activity is neither upward nor downward, when you are right here now? Main subject, Bokushu asked a monk, where are you from? The monk gave a shout, Khats! This is a tradition, Zen shout. Bokushu said, this old monk is shouted down by you, not bad. The monk shouted again. Bokushu said, what about the third and fourth shouts? The monk stayed silent. Bokushu hit the monk and said, now that's a compliment. In Zen, when somebody criticizes you, it's a compliment. Bokushu hit the monk and said, you empty-headed fool. You, sir, are in deep samadhi. Well done. Secho's verse,
Two shouts, three shouts. The knowing one knows well. If going hell-bent, both are blind. Who is blind? Fetch him. Expose him to the world.